Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Carolyn on this last day of November 2007, or the first Monday in December if you're listening to our rebroadcast. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my co-host and mother, Caroline Kilborn.
Welcome, everyone. It's a beautiful day, and today, Friday, is a beautiful day. And we hear there's bad weather coming, but you never know.
We will keep our fingers crossed.
Right.
And with us today is a former Fairfield resident and a friend of mine whom I haven't seen for many years and am delighted to have the opportunity to speak with today. Hi, Meryl Runyon.
Hi.
How are you in Colorado?
Well, it's wonderful in Colorado, and it's always great to reconnect with Fairfield, Iowa.
You were here not too long ago, weren't you?
Oh, I came for a visit. My son still lives there, and I have a lot of friends, and so I had a lovely visit. It's always good to come back.
And how long has it been since you moved away from our fair town?
I think it's been 11 or 12 years.
Oh,
it's
my.
Been quite a while.
Wow.
Yeah, it's been quite a pivotal time, too. A lot has happened since then.
Well, maybe you can fill us in on some of that as we go.
Yeah.
Mom, why don't you tell our audience a little bit about Meryl?
Okay. She is an internationally known speaker and trainer whose clients include IBM, Lockheed Martin, the FBI, Army Intelligence, and Bell South. She's a graduate of Vanderbilt University and has a master's degree in the science of creative intelligence. She has been featured in articles in publications such as USA Today, Women's World, Women in Business Magazine, and Convention South. She's a conflict management and communications expert and is available for convention keynotes and executive coaching. And her books are very interesting.
Meryl's the author of four books. The first one was called Power Phrases, The Perfect Words to Say It Right and Get the Results You Want. Is that correct, Meryl?
That's right. That's the one I started with.
And the second one was?
How to Use Power Phrases to Say What You Mean and Mean What You Say. Get what you want.
And then your two other books, why don't you give us those titles?
I have two management books. One is Perfect Phrases for Managers and Supervisors, and another is How to Say It, Performance Reviews. And then I just had a submission in Jennifer Hawthorne's latest book, Life Lessons for Loving the Way You Live, and I've got two books that I am diligently working on now that I'm hoping to get out quite soon.
Wow.
Now, Meryl, when we look at your bio, there isn't really anything in there that would lead one to expect you to be a writer.
Mm-hmm. Well, I really did find my passion with writing. You know, I wanted to be a speaker for the longest time, and some people might remember me when I was in Fairfield for being a bit of an entertainer. I used to put on variety shows, and I would write songs and sing, and I became a corporate trainer and I still am, but I was very diligently just doing that for a number of years. And it led to writing a book because I saw a need and I filled the need, and things took off from there.
Well, how did you get the training you needed to become a professional speaker in the first place?
I don't really know that I had it when I just started doing it, which is kind of how I've done things much of my life. Now, I was a member of Toastmasters, and you know well, because I think you probably were present at my first Toastmasters speech. You were actually the inspiration for my joining Toastmasters.
I did not know that.
Oh, you were. You absolutely were, yeah. You kept mentioning it. You were very excited about Toastmasters, and I kept wanting to go, and finally I did it.
Oh.
I made a commitment. And oh, I remember my first speech at Toastmasters. I was so scared. I was literally beside myself. It was like I was not present in my body while I did it. And I couldn't look anyone in the eyes. It was so funny, but, you know, it was frightening for me. But that was my beginning.
Well, they say that for a lot of people, public speaking is, they're more afraid of that than of dying.
Yeah, well, honestly, I think if people were given a real choice, it probably
would probably take public speaking.
Yeah.
You know, I have given over 1,000 seminars. I've done a lot of presentations and continue to do them, though not I'm not on the road like I was for many years there. And I still get scared when I get up there. I'm a little nervous talking now, and I've done, you know, with all the interviews that I've done. And I love it, but there's also an adrenal factor, which doesn't enter in with the books so much. Now, with the books, I can really collect my thoughts. I can really put it together in new ways that does exactly what it is I want it to say. Now, I don't have to worry so much about getting the quick sound bites, and I don't have to worry. It's just easier on my adrenals.
Well, if you mess up, you have a chance to correct it without anyone even knowing.
Oh, my gosh, yes. And, you know, I've done the same seminar over hundreds of times, so I've after doing the same thing over and over, it's gotten refined to a very fine level. But still, there's just something about writing that I find very satisfying, and it's in many ways, it's not just my path for sharing what I know and inspiring others. It's my path for reaching my own clarity, which is a lot of why I write.
So do you use your own power phrases when you're dealing with people?
Oh, I absolutely do, and that's another thing that I really love about it. You know, you say you teach what you need to learn, and I come from a very passive background. My history, I just grew up not knowing how to speak up and how to speak out, and so that was something that I needed to learn. And then in all my years of doing training, I saw that other people needed it as well. And so when people would talk about issues they have, and when I helped them find the words they needed to make their points, I could see it was like they grew a few feet taller, and I knew they were actually going to address the issues. So that's when I realized just how important the words are. And so over the years, since I deal with words all day long, every day, I've really gotten into the subtle nuances of it. So I'm quite aware. Now, I'm not going to tell you that I don't ever open my mouth and put my foot in it anymore. I just don't do it quite like I used to.
Well, what exactly is a power phrase?
Well, I have defined a power phrase as a short, specific, targeted expression that says what you mean and means what you say without being mean when you say it.
And I love that last part.
Well, it changes everything, you know.
I
have a lot of people who are with me until the end, and then when they find out they don't get to be mean, they're going, oh, that just doesn't sound so good anymore. But well, that's what makes it so such an art, you know, finding the balance between being very clear and very direct and also being kind.
Right.
One of my dad's favorite sayings was, you can catch more flies with honey than you can with vinegar.
Your dad knew exactly what he was talking about. And, you know, there's a lot of ways, a lot of times we forget that, and we actually communicate in a way that's counterproductive. You know, we think we want to convince somebody, and we do it in a way where they feel dismissed, and so they're not open to hearing us. So it's all about the balance between, you know, what it is we need to say and how it is they can hear it.
And to keep in mind that it's the result, the end result that you're after, not just the not just feeling good while you're, you know, speaking your truth.
Like unloading.
Unloading, exactly.
And that's the third part of the definition. It's targeted. You know what it is you want to accomplish. And so particularly in the critical conversations, the important ones, you want to be sure you know what you want to accomplish, and you keep your eye on the goal. And just as an example, let's say that you have an issue, you've got some kind of conflict going on with someone that you care very much about, but you're dealing with the issue. Well, you want to go in with the idea of what you want to accomplish, and presumably what you want to accomplish is coming out of it feeling closer than ever. Well, that means that going in, keep that in mind, and keep reminding the other person, you know, this is important to me because you matter to me, and I want it to deal with the issues that are separating us, so that you can keep your eye on what you're trying to accomplish, and then you won't be using words that are going to have the opposite effect.
And that's a very different goal than wanting to prove that you're right.
Right, exactly. And what can happen is you can easily go into a conversation with the full intent of going for resolution, mutual understanding, respecting the other person, and then something triggers a reaction, and you switch your goal to proving that you're right. So that's why it's important to keep remembering, all right, I'm looking for resolution here. And sometimes that means you've got to give up winning a battle or two, you know, in order to go for the long-term goal.
One thing you said I thought was interesting, you said that silence is the ultimate power phrase.
Mm. It is, because but not an uncomfortable silence. You know, there's two kinds of silence. There's the kind of silence when there's an elephant in the living room. There's something that's really up that needs to be discussed, and nobody's talking about it.
Yeah, they're just hanging a tablecloth over the elephant.
There you go, yeah, and pretending it's not there. And that is so painful. I have a very low tolerance for that, actually. It makes me crazy. I turn into a raving lunatic when that kind of denial goes on. So that's not the kind of silence that I'm talking about when I say it's the ultimate power phrase. It's the silence that really comes from having said what needs to be said, from having reached a resolution. You know, it's interesting. My husband and I have been married for about 11 years, and we spent a lot of time talking about issues and how to relate to each other and what we wanted and how to treat each other. And now we don't talk so much anymore. We don't have so much to say. That's the ultimate power phrase, because it's been said.
You understand one another.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's the ultimate objective.
Now, what's it like for your husband being married to the expert on communication?
Well, truthfully, he gives me a lot of credit for helping him. He's actually quite diplomatic himself, and he always has been, but he does give me a lot of credit for bringing things down to what matters and back to the heart and all. You know, it's funny. A lot of times people get nervous around me because they think that I'm evaluating every word they say.
And you're not.
Well, actually, I am.
You are.
Now she's
actually, I am, just because I'm always trying it on to see, okay, now how does that feel? And I'm picking up things at work. Like, oh, can I use that in my newsletter? And just noticing the impact. But I'm not from the sense of judging or evaluating. It's more of a constant exploration, because I love words, and my professional focus is about the impact that they have. But it's not in the way people think.
Well, Meryl, speaking of evaluation, I know that that's a very important part of the Toastmasters program, and you spoke about that. How did Toastmasters evaluations influence you?
Well, if you go to my website, there's a link for articles, and I wrote an article for a Toastmasters group. So I'm going to was doing a presentation on power phrases with our Toastmasters group, and I said, well, I'll write an article for you, and you can link to it. So you can find that on my website, and I tell the tale of evaluations. I still don't like evaluations very much, but they're so important. So when I first joined Toastmasters and I went through that fearful initial presentation, the person who did the evaluation at the end, you know, they sum up, tell you what your strengths were, where you need to grow, and the evaluation was something of a whitewash. I mean, he talked about me like I was perfect. They were lucky to have me. There was nothing left for me to learn. I had already arrived. That was the sense.
You sure snowed him, didn't you?
I, when I read that, I was afraid. I was hoping that wasn't me that did that evaluation.
I don't remember who it was, but I do remember the person being male.
Okay, well, then it wasn't me, because I may be a lot of things, but I'm not male.
You're not male, no. So it's pretty distinctive there. And my second and the third evaluation, same story. Now they were singing my praises, and then my fourth evaluation, Bonnie Gould was the evaluator, and she was brilliant. But you know, it was the first time anyone had really pointed out where I needed to improve, and she did it, because it was all about voice tone. The topic was voice tone. That was the thing I was supposed to be working on. And so she started demonstrating what it would have been to had I worked with voice tone better. I mean, she couldn't have been any more clear. I felt betrayed because she was just supposed to tell me how perfect I was.
Because that's what you'd gotten used to.
That's what I was used to. That's the way I liked it. Uh-huh. However, then I entered a competition, a Toastmasters competition, and I wanted good feedback. No, I got serious, and then I started saying, Bonnie, can you come evaluate me? But But she couldn't. But she was just so good, you know, so clear. So that was very important experience for me.
So you really learned a lot from that.
Learned an awful lot from that. Yes, and it was something I needed. It was just that I had a different expectation. And power phrases can be that way too. I mean, it doesn't matter how well you word things. Sometimes, you know, a difficult truth is hard to hear. You want to communicate them in the best and kindest way possible. But sometimes people think, oh, you know, I spoke up and they got upset, therefore I must have done something wrong. And that's not true. And there are times where we need to communicate difficult truths with people, and they are going to react. And it's not our issue that they do. So it's, you know, they say the truth hurts, and sometimes it can. We just try to say it in a way where it leaves the gentlest of wounds possible and does the most good.
You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Carolyn, and our guest today is Merrill Runyon, author of Power Phrases and three related books. Merrill, how did you develop the concept of power phrases?
Well, I was working for a national seminar company, SkillPath Seminars, and they have a book, and had for many years, a book that sells very well called Life Scripts. Now, Life Scripts would map out a conversation from start to finish. So it would set up situations like how to ask your boss for a raise, and it would say, here's your icebreaker. If they say this, then you say that, and it would walk you through the whole conversation, 101 of those. It was a really good seller. And every year at the trainers' conference, the people in the sales department would say, we're looking for the next Life Scripts. So I said, okay, I'll write it. And I did. And I put together a proposal. Now, I want to tell you, this was a very rough proposal. I can't believe they were actually interested based on this proposal. You know, I've never done anything like it before. But they were. You know, they were very interested in it. And so initially they were going to publish it, and then I ended up publishing it, and they start carrying it, which worked out quite well for me. Because it sells so well, and they're buying it for me. But it became one of their top sellers. So that's how I developed power phrases. And while I was teaching seminars, I would give people the words to say things, and I would see that they really liked that. You know, when they got the actual words, they really liked that. So that's where I got the idea to write power phrases.
So it grew organically out of the teaching that you were doing.
Oh, I'll tell you, so my whole career has been very organic in its growth. And in this situation, basically, you know, there was an opportunity, and I saw it, and I took it. And it was a gamble, but it was a gamble that turned out to pay off very well.
Well, how long did it take you to write that first book?
I don't remember exactly. I think I wrote it fairly quickly. I think I wrote it in about 6 months, something like that. And then the layout, that took a really long time because all of the self-publishing aspects were new to me. And back then there wasn't the support for self-publishing that there is now. I mean, it wasn't all that long ago. I think it was 2000, but things have really blossomed for self-publishing now. So it developed as I went. I just wrote. I tend not to be a planner, so I just put it together and the format evolved. Now, my second book, interesting, I wrote for McGraw-Hill, and the publishers, the major publishers, want proposals. So with my second, third, and fourth book, which are all major publishers, I wrote proposals, which had all the chapters laid out and everything described, so I worked from an outline. I couldn't do that with my first one. I had to go through the process kind of from the inside out first. And it's interesting, now I'm working on two books at the same time right now. One of them from an outline, and another one I'm just writing. So,
and why are you doing that? Why are you doing one just writing?
The one that I'm doing just writing, I have just found that it, that's how it's flowing. That's how it's evolving. I don't have an overall picture. of how I want it to go and if the picture is evolving as I write.
Well, here's another question. Why are you doing two at one time?
Well, the reason why I'm doing two at one time is because I have one that I'm doing that my distributor is going to carry. But I got an opportunity to write another one. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, when opportunity knocks, go for it. So the story is I entered a competition on Air America Radio for free ads. And I won. And so I thought, well, okay, if I'm going to be doing ads here, I want to have something targeted to offer this audience. Now, Air America Radio is a political radio station. It's a progressive radio.
Right. And this competition, you actually had to create a radio ad mm-hmm. and submit it. And if I recall, you did that very quickly. You found out about it at the very last minute. And,
oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I found out about it Thursday evening. I had an appointment with my accountant on Friday morning, and it was due in by Friday afternoon.
Oh, man.
So I really threw it together, and it was rough, but there was a little help from my friends who voted for it. And so they interviewed me on the show the next day, and I was talking about say what you mean and mean what you say without being mean when you say it, and how difficult many people find it to discuss political issues. And while I was online, I was getting a lot of emails, people signing up for my newsletter. You know, because my website is speakstrong.com, and right at the front it talks about my free newsletter. And so just every time I checked, I looked, I had, you know, another new subscriber. It was really clear that people were interested in what I was talking about. So I decided, all right, I'm going to write a little e-book about how to discuss political issues. So I'm very interested in politics, and I'm very disturbed by how difficult it is to discuss politics these days. It's very hard to have a civil, reasonable conversation. We're just so polarized. So I started writing, and this has been something that I've been wanting to write about for a long time. And now I thought, okay, I just got to, you know, just going to do it. So I started writing, and it's just been evolving. It's been exploding. And it's been thrilling for me.
So is there a need for you to finish this book really quickly?
Well, the ads are running next week.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So, yeah, there is.
And you started this, what, 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago?
Yeah, I started it a couple of weeks ago. But, you know, here's the thing. It's interesting. Some of my books have taken a long time to write, relatively long. I mean, I work a lot, and so what's long for me is not long for some people, but some of my books I've written more quickly, much more quickly than others. And the reason why some go very quickly is because it's something that's been building inside of me for a long time. It's something I've been observing and processing. So even though it's just pouring out onto the paper, it's the result of even
a long thought
years.
Process. You've been organizing the material in your mind for a long time.
In my mind
time.
And in my heart. And just seeing, okay, what is it that I see here that needs to be said that no one else is saying? And so for the one that I'm writing for the Air America, it's an e-book. Now, this one, I don't know if it's ever going to grow into a big paper book, but I'm doing it as an e-book. It's the first time I've done one like that. And it's to me, this is something that needs to be said, and this is something that I don't hear anybody else saying.
Now, an ebook means that it's just published on the internet,
mm-hmm.
and not, but someone can download it and print it out if they want to read it on paper, but you aren't actually putting it on paper yourself.
Yep, I'm not going through the whole layout and the ISBN and the pub and printers and all, and distribution, all that. I'm just putting it on my website. And you can get to it from speakstrong.com, but I also, the book is called Unite and Concur, and that's in contrast to Divide and Conquer, which is a tactic that many people use politically.
Mm-hmm.
And so I got the website for that, Unite and Concur, because I wanted to separate out my business writing from my political.
Oh, that's a good idea.
Yeah. Well, and here's what's so exciting, and this is what I'm talking about with things kind of morphing and evolving one thing to another. I do diversity training. I do training between the generations and gender training and different communication styles. And so I know how to bridge gaps. And so the subtext of this site is how to navigate the great divide, how to bring people who are different together. And so I realized, okay, the same things that work in a room full of people who work together and don't like each other and basically brings them together, those same tools and techniques can get us having the necessary and important political conversations without judging and dismissing each other like we so often do.
That I think that's very important, because some of my favorite people have very different political opinions than mine.
Yeah, and it triggers, because we are so divisive, I think it's the whole culture that's creating that. There's such a divisive culture that there's a tendency to get so triggered that we can't hear each other.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we're either on this side or we're on that side, and there's no area in the middle. And so I'm talking about why that happens, partly, you know, exactly what's going on in our minds and in our hearts when that happens, and then how to stay open and actually have civil conversation. You know, and it's interesting because it's gotten so divided that I think many of us think it's not even possible. But I believe it is. You know, if men and women can talk to each other, you know, why not Republicans and Democrats? How much more different can they really be?
Well, that's true. That's true.
Yeah.
You're listening.
And we've worked it out. I mean, I'll tell you what, I still really enjoy my times with my girlfriends, and I still really enjoy a good political conversation with someone who thinks everything I say is brilliant.
That is true.
My life are an asset, and so are our political opposites. Once we learn how to unite and concur.
That's a really good way of looking at it.
Well, I have to tell you, I am just so thrilled and excited about what I'm doing. And that's what makes it so fun. Now, there's something else I want to tell you, though, because I know that you speak to people who have aspirations as writers or, you know, who are writers. I cannot say that everything I've tried to write has worked out or flowed. I've had a lot of false starts. You know, and I'll have times, I have a couple of manuscripts that I started that never really caught hold.
And haven't seen the light of day.
And may never. Now, and I see the false starts as part of the whole process. You know, I love writing, and so, you know, if it gets out and sells a lot, well, that's fabulous. But I love the process, and I benefit from it, too, so...
You know, our guest last week made a very similar comment that if you're writing just to sell books, you better go find another career, because it's not easy to make a living as a writer.
Mm-hmm.
But if you love what you're doing, you love what you're writing about, then maybe you have a shot at it.
Yeah. And you know, it's a combination of all of that. You know, it's having something to say that no one else is saying and you think people need to hear. It's a combination of opportunity. You know, like, for example, this was just a couple of weeks ago when I won this radio ad, and so here I am, you know, jumping on this opportunity. And it's also the opportunity of, because it's a need of the time. And it's just being there, you know, ready when the time comes. Now, one thing I do, Monica, that I really recommend is one of the smartest things I ever did was when I started an email newsletter. I think it's been, 5-6 years ago. I do mine every week, every single week. It's a power phrase a week. You can get it at speakstrong.com. And it's more than a power phrase. It's a power phrase and a poison phrase and an Ask Meryl and a success story and comments on the national dialogue. So that keeps me writing. And keeps me thinking.
So you do it every week,
which means
there's a lot of discipline involved.
Well, it's a routine. I suppose it's discipline. I don't really think of it that way. Yeah. Now, recently I also started blogging. And so when I have ideas, I will post them on my blog, and then I gather them together for my newsletter. And so that's also helped me. And what that does is it captures ideas as they come.
Mm.
So they don't get away.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Tell me, when do you sleep?
I actually am a big fan of sleep, and I do that. It's just that I don't have a life outside of that.
Oh, okay.
Well, that's
in the mountains too, but that's part of the process as well.
That's the other thing, is you have to be willing to invest the time, mm-hmm. the effort, and to actually work at it.
Yes.
You know, we sometimes we have this mythology about writers as this real easy life.
Mm-hmm.
You can get up and go to write in your pajamas and your time's your own and you don't have anybody telling you what to do or when to do it. Well, that works until you have a deadline.
Yeah.
Which it sounds like you have a deadline every week.
Well, that's true. That's a mini deadline. It takes anywhere from half an hour to a couple of hours for me to put my newsletter out. And that structure is helpful. There are some times where I would rather not. Actually, this week I put it out a day late, which was pretty radical for me. I was busy working on my Unite and Concur new website, so that's why I got it out late. But it's just to have that structure, you know, something structured in really helps. Now, I know a lot of people having a time of day works well for them. And when I first started writing Power Phrases, it was interesting. I became aware that the minute I get out of bed is my prime time. And so I stopped even washing my face. I would get out of bed and sit at my computer and write. And I would write until I started to get a little bit fried, and then I'd go wash my face.
Oh.
And just getting that start on the day. You know, then I've had other periods in my life. There was a period in my life where, for health reasons, exercise was the most important. So that was the first thing I did. Mm. And I didn't get as much writing done, but I was in pretty good shape. So it's all about priorities.
Right, right. So what is your writing routine like now? Has it morphed over the years? Do you have a...
Yeah, I wouldn't call it a routine so much. I just do it all the time. I get up and I do it, and then I...
And then you eat and then you do it? And
no, and then I go for a hike and then I do it. Occasionally I will go do something else. But
I'll bet as you go for a hike or as you, you know, do something else, you're always thinking.
Well, and actually I've been very deliberate in my hikes much of the time. I will go out with some kind of writing challenge that I want to resolve.
Mm-hmm.
And I carry a little recorder with me, and I record my ideas, because my creative brain is all the more creative when I'm moving around, you know, more than when I'm sitting at the computer.
So capturing your ideas at the time seems to be a very crucial part of what makes you successful as a writer.
Oh, yeah. I would absolutely say that. I will also say I'm not quite as disciplined with that as I could be. Sometimes, like when the moon gets full, I'll wake up in the middle of the night, and I won't want to get out of bed and go to my computer, but I'll be reflecting on things and thinking things through. And I don't always have my little recorder with me, so I sometimes lose a little bit of what I get there. But, you know, at different times of day, you have a different mindset, a different state of consciousness, a different way of looking at things. So that's why it is so helpful.
I'm sure you're right. I didn't think about that before, but I'm sure that's true.
Oh, it is. It's like your brain's working in a completely different way. I mean, sometimes the things that seem brilliant to me at 3 in the morning are kind of ho-hum when I look at it.
Well, yes, we've all had that experience.
Yeah, haven't we, though? Yeah, while we're talking about that, let's talk about, you know, the times when you're writing things and you think, oh, my gosh, this is great. I'm going to be famous. Wait till this gets out. And then you look at it later and go, whoa, you think? Delusional. You know, I always fall in love with what I'm writing when I'm writing it.
Oh, that's good, because a lot of people are always critical of what they're writing when they're writing it.
Oh, not me. Uh-uh. Oh, I love it.
All right.
I am so married to my work. You know, it's my heart is totally engaged in what I do, and then sometimes I'll go back and I'll go, yeah, not quite as good.
Now, do you get feedback from other people as you go along?
Well, I do and I don't. I get feedback on the big things. I'll get feedback on the titles, and sometimes I'll send things out, like my Speak Strong book that I'm working on has a very distinctive structure to it. It's a do's and a don'ts, what to say, what not to say example. So it's very structured. I start out with, it's all about the different skills you need to communicate well, like the skills to communicate emotion. And so I'll start out with stories, and then I'll go through the do's and the don'ts and the tips and that kind of thing. So I run my structure by a lot of people. You know, when I'm not sure of things, I'll run them by, and I'll get feedback that way. So I've formed some groups of people to help me with that. But I don't, and I also have a proofreader because I can't spell. I'm very good at spelling. But I don't have a lot of editorial input. In fact, my three books that I did, two with McGraw-Hill and one with Penguin, I had almost no editorial input. One of them, I had a contract for 50,000 words, so I turned in a book that was 53,000 words, a manuscript. And he sent it back and said, it's fabulous, that's the good news, the bad news is it's too long, you got to cut it down by a third.
What?
Yeah, you know, he said it needs to be 35,000 words, even though I had a contract for 50,000.
Wow.
Yeah, so my other two books, I made it real clear how many words they want, because they have standard contracts. I mean, there is such a mass marketing mentality there. Well, it's not just mentality, that's what the system's set up for, that they don't, that everything's standardized and a lot of details don't get dealt with. So my two subsequent books, I made it very clear that though the contracts called for 50,000, I really didn't think they wanted 50,000, and when we talked about it, they agreed. But anyway, so that one, all the editing he did was he cut it down by a third. And then on my second book, my editor changed one word in it. And
wow.
My third book, she made a few changes that were fairly cosmetic.
Wow.
So,
when your first editor cut it by a third, did he just cut out whole sections, or did he actually...
asked me to do it.
He asked you to do it. Ah.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so, you know, it's like, which of your children are you going to keep?
Oh, dear. That must be tough. Let me ask
you. Actually, I made an audio out of that. And so I have the whole, the unabridged version in the audio, so I didn't end up eliminating all of it.
Yeah, good idea. Let me ask you this. Is body language very important for when you're using power phrases?
Well, congruence in general is important. You know, every part of you needs to be communicating the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so body language certainly is a very important part of it, which is another funny little Toastmasters story. I went on to win the foot competition that I was entering in. And I had people had told me that I slumped. I didn't believe them. But then there was a picture of me holding my award, and there I was with this very unassertive posture.
Mm.
And so I was looking at the picture of myself in my newsletter thinking, you know, this is supposed to be a prize moment, but I don't look like a winner here. So, yeah, body language is absolutely important.
And you really have to see pictures of yourself or film of yourself to
That's my experience, you know. People can tell you, but until you see it for yourself.
Yeah.
I don't like watching video of myself.
Well, I don't either. And when I first started doing promotional videos, I don't find it as painful as I used to because I'm getting better. But when I first started watching my promotional videos, I thought I was being passionate and strong. And I look at it and I set my jaw. And I look hard.
Oh.
Mm.
It wasn't what I was trying to project. And so for me, watching those videos, the biggest thing I've learned is look pleasant. Look pleasant. Someone you might want to know.
Yeah. Well, you know, none of us ever likes our own pictures, even professional pictures, you know.
Oh, still pictures I can handle. It's just a video.
I had a great photo shoot last February, and I really do like all those pictures. Of course, you know, they were touched up nicely.
Mm-hmm.
But
oh, yeah,
I
that
really
helps.
Don't realize that I'm getting older until I look at pictures.
Oh, you're not getting older.
Oh, okay.
It's getting better.
somehow, you know, when I look at pictures that aren't at, like, my great fate photo shoot, you know, I look at that face every day in the mirror and don't notice.
Yeah, it's true. It does have a habit of catching up with you.
There you go, yeah.
Well, you're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Meryl Runyon. Meryl, do you have a selection from one of your books or one of your other projects that you'd like to read to our audience today?
Well, I do, and this is the foundation of why I do what I do. You know, it's my signature story, my big motivator, and I actually write about this in my different books and even in my new Unite and Concur to Navigate the Great Political Divide book, because it's important, I think, for people to understand my motivation. But I wrote about it specifically in a contribution that I have in Life Lessons for Loving the Way You Live, which is Jennifer Hawthorne's new Chicken Soup for the Soul book.
Jennifer was our
guest.
It's
called Some Boats Need to Be Rocked. Shall I go for it?
Yes, please.
Please do. This is Meryl Runyon.
All right. Some boats need to be rocked. My earliest memory of being unable to speak for myself goes back to when I was 4 years old. I was allowed to cross the street, one block in every direction. When our neighbor found me playing across the street, he didn't believe I had permission to cross. He brought me home in disgrace and ran it on and on as if he were some kind of superhero who had saved me and the planet from certain destruction. No one spoke for me. Inwardly, I screamed, one block in any direction. I'm allowed. Why aren't you telling him? Outwardly, I could only cry. I doubt my mother understood why I cried so hard. I also doubt she understood what she taught me that day. She may have thought she taught me to put my best foot forward, but she actually taught me to put a false front forward. She taught me that if someone is likely to object to what you have to say, you don't say it. She taught me that if the truth is likely to rock the boat, you stay silent, you pretend. So that's what I did. The first half of my life was based on the theme of putting a front forward that wouldn't rock the boat, create waves, or even cause a tiny ripple. That continued until I avoided a ripple that was really an early tsunami warning. The tsunami was my late husband Mike's cancer. And as an aside, some people might know, have known him, Mike Runyon. The ripple I avoided was his wrath when I voiced my concerns about early indications that something was terribly wrong. I got a clue of that when I read a passage in a book telling how Harvey Peterson beat his tumor to the punch. I was shocked to realize that Harvey's symptoms sounded just like Mike's. I showed the passage to Mike, who took the book, threw it across the room and screamed, "Damn it, Meryl, I don't have cancer, and don't talk to me about it again. Don't you dare say anything to my mother." I responded in what had become my habitual way. If my husband was upset with me, obviously I had done something terribly wrong. If I had done something wrong, I needed to avoid doing that again. So I returned to the, quote, safer waters of agreeing with him. I almost drowned 9 months later when I lost him to untreated cancer. After Mike died, I considered myself a victim of his denial. It took a year for me to realize I was really a volunteer who chose to put a false front forward when heartfelt, extreme honesty was the only hope we had. It happened at my counselor's office. The counselor interrupted himself mid-sentence to ask, "Why is your hand over your mouth? Whose hand is that? Who is keeping you from speaking?" I was stunned to realize I had my own hand over my mouth. I had silenced myself, and it had always been my own hand over my mouth. Mike could never have silenced me had I not chosen to allow it. I silenced myself because I didn't want to rock the boat. Now I realize that some boats desperately need to be rocked. If I don't speak for myself, no one else will. I became a woman on a mission. Mission to figure out how to rock the boats that need to be rocked without capsizing or sinking. That was over 20 years ago. I've rocked a lot of boats since then. It didn't happen overnight. Once I realized I had lost my voice, it took years to find it again. I started small in safe environments. I started speaking up and out in the safe haven of my counselor's office. That was harder than you might think because of my habit of, quote, making nice, which was so deeply entrenched. I started being stronger with my son. You know, I wondered, was it possible for that beautiful being of light to actually be manipulating me? I set better boundaries with my boyfriend. He resisted, and we broke up. I began to say no to my clients more often. Some of them didn't like it, but I sure did. After 10 years of reclaiming my voice, I contacted a seminar company and told them I wanted to work for them, even though I had no relevant experience. They said no. A year later, I contacted them again and told them I still wanted to work for them. They said yes. Speaking up for what I wanted worked, and it really felt good. In my role as a seminar leader, I began encouraging others to address issues and to be their own advocates. I noticed how empowered people became when they got the right words, what I call power phrases, to address their own hot-button issues. Sometimes they actually seem taller. I adopt a simple phrase that epitomizes my approach to communication. Say what you mean what you say, but don't be mean when you say it. Looking back, it's possible that had I had the words and the communication skills when my husband became ill, he would still be with me today. It was one of the most treatable kinds of cancer there was. But there are no guarantees. I still may have lost him, but I would not have lost myself. It's much easier to weather losses and setbacks when you know you were true to yourself at every turn. Mm-hmm. When I compare life now to my pre-tsunami life, the contrast is stunning. I used to live in a constant state of resentment. Now I've almost forgotten what resentment feels like. I used to have chronically conflicted emotions. Now inner conflict is rare for me. But best of all, while I used to hide behind a false front, I'm authentic now. I love being me, and I love helping others be themselves. I also love saying what I mean and meaning what I say without being mean, and I say it.
That's great.
Yeah.
It is. I want to ask you, you say that it's easy to find the flaw in other people's thinking. It's harder to find out how it makes sense to them. Could you explain that?
Well, one of the questions, this one's actually borrowed, this phrase I'm going to give you now, from the book Crucial Conversations, mm-hmm. which is fabulous, and I wish I'd written, but I'm glad someone else did. and the question that it suggests is asking yourself, how would a reasonable person respond in this situation? Because when we're in conflict and we're not seeing eye to eye with someone, the assumption is, I misphrased it, why would a reasonable person be reacting this way? Because it's very easy for us to assume that they're being unreasonable, not looking for how it all makes sense to them. Now, so the foundation of power phrases, you know, the foundation is to communicate what you think, what you feel, and what you want. But it's also to have the same awareness of the person in front of you and to listen for those things. What do they think? What do they feel? What do they want? And then, as they would tell you in Crucial Conversations, what makes it reasonable in their mind? Why mm-hmm. would a reasonable person be acting this way? And so it's all understanding, which brings me to another great teacher, Stephen Covey, who says to understand all is to forgive all.
Mm.
That's foundational to everything. I absolutely believe that's true.
I agree with that.
It's a good philosophy, isn't it?
It is. To understand all is to forgive all.
Well, and when you come from that foundation, you know, I am judgmental of you right now, so obviously I'm not understanding you.
Mm-hmm.
No, when you can recognize that your own judgments are the result of not understanding, it sure helps conversations.
Wow.
It sure helps you unite and concur. It sure helps you come to the same side of the fence instead of being adversarial from the opposite sides.
How do you develop your butter voice?
The butter voice, I've had a number of people tell me this was extremely useful to them. That when you're saying something that is potentially charged, that you pretend you're just asking someone to pass the butter. So it's like you're saying, please pass the butter. I'm very upset with this situation. please pass the butter. By Thursday, please pass the butter. That's my husband's lap you're sitting in.
Please pass the butter.
Well, there are extremes. So, and let me also add that to understand all may mean to forgive all, but it doesn't mean to tolerate and accept all. You still draw boundaries. You just do it with an open heart.
Yeah, a good point.
Yeah.
Very good point.
You know, Meryl, I've known you for quite a long time, but not as long ago as you were talking about in the selection you read. I did not know your husband. I did not know you then. But it's hard for me to imagine that you were that passive, because in all the time I've known you, you've always been very strong. And
one thing, we sometimes when you compare insides and outsides, it's a different story.
Mm.
But also, Monica, you and I, we were in a songwriters group, and we would come together and share our songs. And that was so important to me. It's so valuable because the songs that I wrote were my way of reclaiming my identity. And I loved the group. The group was fabulous because I would bring a really rough song that had very little merit at all, but it was just a beginning. And the group was just fabulous at helping to draw out what the essence was contained inside of that. So as long as you've known me, I've been very focused on communicating and on finding my voice and figuring out exactly what it is I have to say. And I'm sure that as a songwriter yourself, you'll relate when I say this, that when I got the words to a song just right, or yes, that's what I'm trying to say, I would feel like I had resolved that particular situation or emotion. Another thing that's very interesting was my songs were very adversarial. There was a lot of pain in them, highly emotional for a long time. And for me, that was central to healing and to finding my voice. It was a part, it was a step along the way. And then, as they did their job and did their work, they became more of a unified perspective and more from a sense of wholeness.
Now, Meryl, are you still writing songs?
I'm not still, well, yes, but they look like books.
Well, music being part of the soul and coming from the soul and the heart.
Oh yeah.
You can say things in a song that you can't say, just say.
Mm-hmm. Well, and songs are great in that they make you capture the essence. You know, when you get to the formula, and I always remember our mutual friend Phyllis Kerr talking about when you get to the chorus, you lead up to it by saying, "And that's why I say." And then you summarize the whole thing. Well, now I use that to get my title. You know, not so much the hooks to my songs or the choruses. It's for my titles. And the songs are much longer. But I see it that way. You know, one of the reasons why I gave up songwriting was that I couldn't sing all that well. I wasn't horrible, but I sure didn't have the voice to carry me through. Well, when I started teaching seminars, they don't care that I can't sing.
Well, that's true. Did you ever sing in your seminars?
Well, I did, and most of the feedback I got was positive.
Mm-hmm.
But occasionally I would get a comment, because I got evaluated by everyone in all my seminars, like 300 evaluations a day. That made Toastmasters look like nothing.
Whoa, I guess.
And so someone would write, "Don't sing, it's embarrassing."
Oh.
Okay, maybe I won't.
Well, Meryl, we're certainly glad that you're still speaking and speaking out
and writing.
And we're running out of time. We're actually out of time. But thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, it's lovely to reconnect. I want to invite anybody who's listening to visit my website at speakstrong.com.
And you've been listening to Meryl Runyon on Writer's Voices. And hope it's not so long before I see you again.
We'll make sure it's not.
Okay.
Good.
Goodbye.
Bye.
And next week, our guest on Writer's Voices is Gungaji, who has just released a book on SoundsTrue.com Press, a collection of some of her favorite, most loved teachings. And so we're looking forward to speaking with her next week. And as we close, do we have a quote from Mom?
We do. You know, if everyone demanded peace instead of a television set, then there would be peace.
Writers' Voices is hosted, produced, and engineered by Monica Hadley, Caroline Kilborn, and Shemaine Montana. Archives available at KRUUFM.com and WritersVoices.com. Writers' Voices is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa.